date is Tuesday, March the 1st, 2022. The book we are discussing, The Family Role, An American Story by Joshua Prager.
Joshua Prager. It's a privilege to have him here. He's a journalist who has written for Vanity Fair, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal. He's a former Nieman Fellow at Harvard University and a Fulbright Distinguished Chair. He's the author of The Echoing Green and another book, The 100 Years, and he's coming to us from his home in New Jersey, where he lives with his wife and two daughters.
The very beginning of his important new book, Joshua makes very clear why the story of Norma McCorvey, the woman behind the pseudonym Jane Roe of Roe v. Wade, is worthy of such lengthy, detailed treatment. After all, Josh notes, Roe v. Wade is arguably the best-known Supreme Court case. It's certainly the most enduringly divisive, having become a political Rorschach test and rallying cry. And now, of course, nearly half a century since the case was decided, the precedent it set is up for reconsideration by the current Supreme Court. Josh, who used to be a senior writer for the Wall Street Journal and has written for several other publications, spent more than a decade on this book and says in the acknowledgments that it was difficult. Everything about it was fraught, he writes, but he stuck with it. And the result is a work that deeply explores not only the complicated, contradictory life of McCorvey, who died 4 years ago, but also her family's history, the lives of her three daughters, other protagonists in Roe v. Wade, the court's decision, and the social movements surrounding it.
If you could tell us the story of how this book got started 10 years ago, that would be a great starting point.
So it was 11 years ago, and I was in Provence, and I was reading an article in The New Yorker about gay marriage. And the article mentioned in passing that sometimes a plaintiff is good for the cause she represents, and sometimes not so much. And in the latter category, they cited Norma McCorvey, Jane Roe, because she famously switched from the pro-choice side to the pro-life side. And then it noted something that I had not realized. It said that she was not able to have the abortion despite the fact that she had sought, because it's now obvious to me a law case takes longer than a pregnancy. In fact, she was pregnant in 1969. She filed Roe in 1970, but Roe was not decided until January of 1973. And all of a sudden my mind sort of leapt to who that person was, that child whose conception had occasioned the lawsuit. And I said to myself, he or she would be 40 years old at that time in 2010. And it seemed to me that they probably had learned who they'd been born to. And not only that, had they learned, it would be a very difficult thing to carry. And those assumptions turned out to be correct. So it was that strange sort of realization, that light bulb, that led me into this 10-year affair.
So what about Norma McCorvey? I mean, her, Shelley's mother. I mean, she is such a complicated figure.
Very helpful for me to sort of keep that larger family in mind while I was writing about Norma and her daughters. And to just sort of give one example, I look back not only at Norma's life, but at her family. And she was born in Louisiana along the Atchafalaya River. And what I learned was that not only Norma, but her mother and also her grandmother, their lives were also upended by unwanted pregnancies. And all three of these generations What happened was it seemed to those women and their families that sex and religion were completely incompatible. So when one was suddenly pregnant, she was made to sort of marry in great haste, and that had great implications. The next one, when she found herself pregnant and not married, it was very tragic. This was Norma's mother. She was made to sort of leave their little town in Louisiana, go to Baton Rouge, give birth to the child, and give that child up. That child was then raised by her mother. And these tragedies really had incredible consequences. And it is my belief that America at large also struggles with abortion mightily, in part, obviously there are other reasons, politics, et cetera, we could talk about, but in part because, again, of this sort of seeming incompatibility of sex and religion.
So would you mind telling us the story of how you found Shelley? Because I think that's a pretty interesting one.
Yeah. So I first just reached out to Norma and I said, you know, I identified myself and wondered if she would speak to me about this. And she said, I had to pay her. And I explained that I couldn't do that. And so she said, no, she would not help me. And I started reading about her and I learned that she had had a partner of many years. She was gay. She had to renounce her homosexuality when she went over to the pro-life side. We can discuss that and the horrible toll it took on Norma. But this woman named Connie Gonzalez had stood by Norma through decades of sort of neglect and combustibility. Norma was a very difficult person. Also, incredible infidelity. She had, by her own count, hundreds of partners. She was, in fact, a prostitute for a time. Nobody knew that until I sort of wrote about it in my book. But Connie told me when I reached out to Connie that Norma had actually just left her 1 year prior, a few years after Connie had a stroke. And I went to go visit Connie in Texas, and she was there. And my whole book is based in Texas. All of the characters are in Texas. And she was there, and she was with her niece, who was her caretaker. And I went back to visit Connie a second time 6 months later. And I had failed a few times in my attempts to learn who Norma's daughter was. For example, I reached out to the sister of the adoption attorney who had brokered the adoptions of Norma's children. That attorney, Henry McCluskey, was a very important man, and he sadly was murdered just a few months after Roe, having nothing to do with Roe. but I had struck out. When I went back to Connie the second time, she mentioned to me that sadly her home was about to be foreclosed on, and Norma's private papers were in the garage and were about to be thrown out. And I said, please do not throw those papers out. Those are important papers. Can I have them? And she said, yes. And she and her niece put them into garbage bags for me. And I put them into the trunk of my rental car. And I later acquired those papers from Norma. She did not want them. And those papers are now actually at a research library at Harvard. But they were incredibly important. And when I first just sort of looked through the papers, I was simply looking for a date of birth, the date of birth of her youngest child, the quote unquote Roe baby. And it was on one piece of paper, one out of thousands. Norma had mentioned that that child had been born in June 2nd, 1970. She mentioned it in a conversation that she had with a Catholic newsletter. And from there, I learned just going online that there had been 37 girls born in Dallas County on that date. And from there, it was just sort of another month or so until I found her. And I didn't know for sure that she knew that she had been born to Norma. And so I didn't want to disrupt her life and say, by the way, you know, in case you didn't know. And so I reached out to the woman who had raised her, to her mother. And her mother, and I asked if she knew the name Henry McCluskey, the adoption attorney. And she said right away, yes, and we know about Norma too. She then asked her daughter, Shelley, if Shelley wished to speak with me. And Shelley said that she did not. And so I promised her that I would never write about her against her wishes. And I then set off to look for Norma's other two daughters. And I found them. And they have fascinating stories too. And I then, a year later, went back to Shelley's mother. And I said, by the way, I have found Norma's other two daughters. At that point, Shelley called me and said that she wished to participate in my book. She was excited to meet those sisters. All three had looked in vain for one another. And so that was really the beginning of the book.
The Texas law that severely restricts access to abortion in that state has set off a furious round of public debate and private legal strategizing. But it is only the latest effort in a decades-long battle to overturn the landmark Supreme Court case legalizing most abortions, Roe v. Wade. That case has been a touchstone for both sides of the abortion issue since it was delivered nearly 50 years ago. And yet, for all the attention Roe v. Wade has received over the years, some facts about the case remain obscure to much of the public, such as the fact that the pregnancy at the part of the legal dispute did not end with an abortion. A baby girl was born, and a few knew who or where she was. And after a series of disturbing encounters, she preferred to keep it that way. But now she's given journalist and author Joshua Prager permission to reveal her identity in his new book, The Family Row, An American Story. And Joshua Prager is with us now. So you've met her, and you tell her story now. Who is she?
So her name is Shelley Lynn Thornton. She was born in June of 1970, a few months. I know exactly who she was.
I don't know. How do we even think about Norma McCorvey?
Well, Norma was a very complicated person. Norma was conflicted about abortion. On the one hand, you know, she felt that a woman ought to have the right to choose. On the other hand, she was raised in a very religious home, and she was told that this is absolutely forbidden. And even as she was proud, as the years went by, of her role in Roe, she was ambivalent about it. And even a greater reason why she then left the pro-choice for the pro-life movement was that she didn't feel that she had a seat at the table in the pro-choice movement. She wasn't exactly the greatest representation for her movement. She was an unstable and unreliable witness. She lied all the time. And she wasn't often invited to the press conferences and the book parties and the rallies. And she came to resent that. But at the end of her life, she really felt that she didn't have a place in either movement. And she pushed it all away. And she wanted it known that she had never had an abortion. She wanted everyone to know that she'd actually had three children.
Well, the other aspect of the story, I mean, you describe these sort of big feelings, mm-hmm. and particularly how so many women have been, how can we put this, captive of forces beyond their choice and control,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But one of the points you make in the book is that this kind of extended to Shelley. There was this ongoing effort to use her,
yeah,
for various people's purposes, including her mother's purposes.
Absolutely.
And how does she think about that now?
So she came to realize a few days before she was 19, when she was alerted to who her biological mother was, that people saw her as a symbol. It was the National Enquirer that sort of tracked her down. And the investigator and the reporter said, you know, the pro-life community wants to show you off as a happy, living, healthy individual. And she wanted no part of that. She was actually sort of conflicted herself, much like her biological mother. She had an unwanted pregnancy herself a few years later before she was married, and she felt that abortion, as she put it, was not part of who I am. And she didn't have an abortion. She believed that a woman should have the right to choose. So that experience sort of deepened her thinking on it, as one would imagine it would. And most importantly, though, she wanted no part, as I say, of what the pro-life saw in her, this symbol, as somebody who embodied their argument against abortion, someone who was the incarnation of that argument. If anything, she told me, she represented what it is to be born unwanted. Mm-hmm. Of course, while there are tens of millions of children who are sadly born unwanted, only her conception had led to Roe. And so she carried a burden that was really unique.
And I know one of the things that's really striking about this book, too, is that if you write about Norma, you're not writing on a blank slate, because lots of people, as you mentioned, in the pro-life movement have written about Norma, and the pro-choice movement have written about Norma. And probably most significantly, Norma wrote a lot about Norma, right? She had two, I think at least two books about her own life. And so I guess, first of all, how was it writing against that background? And how did you find that Norma had invented a version of herself very different from the one you were uncovering in her papers and otherwise?
So the papers sort of were totally disorganized, but little by little, they were sort of a guide helping me navigate the crazy life that Norma had lived. There would be the name of a human being, and I didn't know who that was, and it would turn out to be an ex-girlfriend of hers. Or there would be the name of an abortion clinic where it turned out that she had worked, and on and on and on. There were taxes, there were letters that were written to her. There was sort of everything. And those papers, plus a decade of research, so interviewing hundreds and hundreds of people and looking for those people, enabled me to sort of strip away the real just fictions. These two autobiographies that Norma wrote were complete fictions. It's sort of amazing what she did was, and it's sad and telling. She reimagined herself as not a sinner, but as a victim. This was very important to her. So to give a few examples, when she had a consensual affair with a woman who was about to become a nun in Catholic school, Norma wrote that she had been raped by that woman. When she begged her mother, her own mother, to take her first child off her hands and raise that child, her daughter Melissa, rather than writing that her own mother had adopted her child, which was true, she wrote that her mother kidnapped her child. Another example, Norma was shot at. Her home was shot at in 1989. And she told everyone that this happened because she was Jane Roe, when in fact, she and Connie told me it had to do with a drug deal that went wrong. Norma was dealing drugs at the time. And so over and over and over again, I sort of found out what really happened. And then when I did, sometimes Norma joked, she said to me once, I like my version better. But I said, you know, Norma, we help me here, get the truth down. And she did help me. She actually wanted to know exactly what had happened. She'd lived a difficult and complicated life. She didn't remember exactly what had happened. The story she had told had sort of supplanted the realities of her life. And so she did help me. She was thrilled, for example, when she remembered for me the name of the man who was the biological father of her youngest child. And so on and on and on over the course of hundreds of hours with Norma over the last 4 years of her life, I was able to sort of put that life together.
I'm fascinated by Norma's desire to frame herself as a victim. I imagine some of that was, I'm curious about why she did that. And I'm also curious about how that narrative suited really both social movements, because the idea of Norma's victimhood resonates so strongly in abortion politics, and it has for decades. So I don't know if, I imagine her reasons went beyond that, but I'm curious both why you think she felt the need to unveil this story, and then how it fits so perfectly what social movements were trying to accomplish.
But above all, sex was a complicated, forbidden thing. And particularly when Norma came out to her mother and father and really sort of discovered her lesbianism when she was away in a boarding school for quote unquote delinquent children. And her mother told me, I was able to interview her mother, Mary, that she beat her because her daughter was gay. And Norma pushed that away. And she lived sort of who she was, lived authentically, I think, for a few years. But Roe complicated that. Norma was obviously Jane Roe in 1970 when the case was filed. But it wasn't really until the late 1980s that she began to sort of look for the spotlight. She wanted to represent this movement. She wanted to help represent Roe, which she began to call, quote, my law. And unfortunately for her, she was marginalized by the pro-choice movement. In fairness to that movement, she was an unreliable narrator. She had recanted one lie already. She had said that she had become pregnant, led to Roe. She said it had come via a rape, but that was a lie. And they didn't trust her. But still, even after she recanted that lie and worked very hard to sort of promote choice, they didn't really give her a seat at the table. That was very difficult for her. And she became very angry and disillusioned. And one way, and I know I'm venturing a little bit off your question, but that she was able to sort of get back at them, she said, oh yeah, you're not going to take me seriously. Well, I'm going to make you take me seriously. And she then switched over to the pro-life side in 1995. And just one note on that, it wasn't that her conversion was only a way to get back at the pro-choice. Religion was something that gave her genuine comfort. But that was a big part of it. And in terms of, you know, the narrative that she invented for herself, the pro-life obviously made great use of this born-again woman who is leaving the pro-choice side and she's no longer gay and on and on and on. But she was, in the privacy of her home, tormented by this. And she actually did what they asked her to do. She left her partner's bed. They slept in separate beds after that. Norma told me that she still had affairs, but she no longer shared the bed of her partner, Connie. And she was really tormented by that until the end of her life.
You call it an American story. The title of your book is The Family Row, an American story. Why do you say that?
Well, the family really refers here to two different families. There's the family that Norma had, a broken family, Norma and the three children she relinquished to adoption. But then there's also the much larger family, as I see it, the tens of millions of people who are on either side of this issue. And what's fascinating to me is that Norma was the only thing that the pro-choice and the pro-life sort of had in common, because she'd started off on one side and gone to the other. And what I tried to do was tell the larger story through the smaller story. And as I say, you know, Norma's family, her immediate family, was sort of rent and riven by the incompatibility, as she saw it, of sex and religion. And that is the exact same thing in my mind that has brought America apart, pulled America apart on this issue. And so by humanizing the issue, by enabling people to look at abortion not through politics, but people, I tried to sort of shine a light on how America got to this sad point.
The Supreme Court has a Mississippi case in front of it now, a ban on abortion at 15 weeks that many people expect the court will uphold. And really the question then becomes, as Josh said, whether the court then reverses Roe sooner, like in the summer of 2022, or maybe in a year or two. And so I think, given that we're kind of on the cusp of a decision potentially overruling Roe, how do you think your book kind of helps people understand where we are and where we might be going? You mentioned, which is when survival outside the womb is possible, and that's, you know, depending on the hospital and the pregnancy, but give or take 24 weeks. So far, much after 15 weeks. So for the court to say Mississippi's law is okay, the court either has to say viability has to go or Roe has to go. And we know one of those two things is quite likely to happen. We know, as you mentioned, that there are six justices on the court who've been placed there by presidents who vowed to see Roe overturned, including the decision may help resolve this conflict. And here we are 50 years later with your book and no end in sight, right? And so I think we're likely to see the story continue, right? There'll be room for a sequel.
Is the very fact that abortion rests legally on sort of privacy and just sort of intuitively on privacy makes it a complicated thing say that a lot of people who assailed Roe's reasoning, this, you know, the idea that, as Linda Coffey had it, to sort of hinge her argument on privacy, even many people in the pro-choice movement did, because they felt that this right ought to be rooted in equality, not privacy. And what was so fascinating was that when Casey, the case, Planned Parenthood v. Casey in 1992, which was about abortion restrictions, and it was the last time before now that Roe was really in grave danger. It was sort of rescued, and the opinion changes the way that the court thinks about it. It switches over to equality. I'll just read you one sentence that I'd sort of put up on my screen. This is something that Justice Souter, who was really the justice who engineered the rescue of Roe, something he writes. He says, "The ability of women to participate equally in the economic and social life of the nation has been facilitated by their ability to control their reproductive lives." So that was this fascinating change in the sort of reasoning behind the law.
Well, you know, the timing is remarkable. I mean, after 10 years of working on this project, your book arrives at the very moment that the Supreme Court will soon hear a case that may well determine the fate of Roe. And I can't help but ask if you feel comfortable saying, what is, does Shelley and her, perhaps even her sisters, Norma McCorvey's daughter, does she have thoughts about that?
They do. All three of Norma's daughters spoke to me about the fact that they do believe in a woman's right to choose, even if they themselves had never felt comfortable to have an abortion. And it's not only that Shelley does believe that abortion ought to be legal, she also wants people to know, as she puts it, that she is not a symbol for one side of this issue. She is her own person, distinct and apart from Roe and abortion.
I don't think this book will be completely satisfying to one side or the other, because
right,
it was complicated. And I didn't decide where the book was going to go. I followed the book where it went.
In the final pages of the book, you quote Henry Taylor, a pastor who Norma knew later in life. They went drinking together. He, as he was leaving her funeral, said, "In my 50 years, I've never met a more exploited person." Yeah. Do you think this is true, or do you think that Norma brought agency to the work that she did, the approach she took to her life?
I think it's true that Norma gave as good as she got, and I think it's true that she was able, sort of against incredible odds, to navigate really like shark-infested waters. These personalities on both sides of these issues were massive, powerful, wealthy organizations. Sarah Weddington, we mentioned Gloria Allred, Gloria Steinem. Then you have all these powerful people on the other side, the Catholic Father Pavone, the evangelical Flip Benham, and on and on and on. And Norma sort of managed to do okay, to survive and to eke out a living. But it's also true, unfortunately, that she was horribly exploited. I mean, you read in the book, I wrote it, it was sort of depressing to write some of these things, where these people, she had been so good for the bottom line of some of these big organizations like Priests for Life. And there they are sort of, you know, not helping at all, helping her out at the end of her life. The fact that she was penniless at the end of her life is a real indictment, I think, of both movements. She gave her body to one movement and she gave her soul to the other, and they were not there for her. And that is sad. And I think the truth of the matter is, there was a line by another person I quote in there, Cass McMahon, a pro-choice advocate, who says, you know, the movement never takes care of you. And there was a great difference, as I saw it, between the leaders and the sort of grassroots. The grassroots people on both sides of this issue, to be honest, treated Norma very, very well. They were also more capable of nuance. They were capable of understanding that these issues are complex. They understood why Norma sort of wasn't so sure. They believed abortion was fraught for good reason, even though they themselves had come down on one side of the issue. But the leaders of the movements, unfortunately, did not treat Norma well.
Hello, can you hear me?
Hey, Brad, left there with those right there. Donald Queen, left there with the right there. Deuteronomy and do this. Those in those.
Okay. We have.
Brad, left there with Alan Levely, computer audio 16, Mike Kathy Snyder. Kathy Snyder, David F., computer audio.
David, do you have any? Can you read the book?
Who are you asking?
Yeah, are you unmuted?
Are you asking Alan? I didn't hear you. Who you called?
I said David, but I'll ask Alan. He's first on the list. 16, 19, 16, let's go just through the list. Yeah.
Listen to me. David F is still muted, so everybody unmute yourselves. So I'll go ahead, Don, if that's okay. I got 60% through. I didn't. This was a beast of a book because. Prager really, really did his research, I got to say. And it reads like a novel. And I tell you, he did a really good job with the story. But I got to tell you, it is hard going reading. I'm very lucky. I was born in a family that cared about me and that were real close and stuff. I can't imagine what it must have been like for Norma. I can't say that I really liked her very much because I understand, you know, it's hard to get a real feel for what it must have liked to be in her shoes. But man, I've never read anything about anybody that lied so much. Well, maybe with the exception of her. Well, I won't get into politics. But anyway, she was a master at trying to. When I hear these guys saying about how exploited she was, okay. But man, it's hard to feel sorry for when I didn't really get the sense that she ever told the truth ever. So that made it difficult for me. I mean, and let's be honest, calling this her law, I mean, she happened to be pregnant and wanted an abortion at the time they were trying to file a lawsuit. She didn't have anything to do with any of this stuff. So, I thought it was a good read. I'm glad I was exposed to a lot of the background. You know, a lot of this stuff I just was clueless about, and I'm going to try to finish it. But like, I'm like 11 hours into, I'm like 60% into the book, and then I ran out of time. But I'm glad you picked it, because this is a good thing that we ought to know, and it's awfully timely right now with everything going on. But I'm going to comment on what Prager said at the end of that interview. You talking about how she was exploited and stuff. You know, when you're reading crime fiction and stuff, one of the adages is you follow the money to try to figure this stuff out. Well, if you want to find out who's going to treat somebody with respect and kindness and understanding stuff, don't follow the money, because that's not where you're going to find it. But, and this is typical. I mean, the folks with the money are usually the ones that act like jerks and stuff. But anyway, that's enough for me. Thanks.
Well, thanks, Ellen.
Can I say something? It's Mary Ellen. I wish that this book had been out in 1974, because I worked for an agency and we were a referral agency to problem pregnancies and adoption. And we would send people literature on all the choices they had. And this would have been a tremendous background for that, because there were many people who wanted abortions. And we could never tell them to get an abortion, but we could send them the information so that they could, you know, have other choices. But the book was, to me, very fascinating. Just because of my experience working in this field for 2 years. Thank you.
Well, thank you. I might add that I, about 74, I was a social worker with a caseload. We were doing everything we could to keep people from getting pregnant and supporting the children for 18 years. And about that time, Reagan signed the law making abortions legal. And the first case I was aware of, though, was a coworker, her daughter, had got an abortion. So it affects everybody.
You mean the California law that Reagan signed?
Yes. Yeah, when he was governor.
Okay.
Yeah. And then Redford, they said in the book, Jefferson, Mildred, she talked Reagan into changing his mind. Bless his heart.
I can go next if you'd like.
Go, David.
Okay. I won't say a lot. I read parts of the book and skimmed parts. I felt bad for Mildred Jefferson, I think her name was, because she just needed to have come along at a time when her skills would have been appreciated. She could have been a surgeon, and it's like it warped her and it soured her and it ruined somebody who I think would have been able to contribute. It's like she got broken and she couldn't fix herself, and she latched on to all of this and got really intense about it, just like several other people did. I was going to mention, when it mentioned the Atchafalaya River in Simsport, I'm 69 miles from Simsport. You know, this is definitely part of the country I live in. I had no idea Roe v. Wade, that Madam Roe, had a Louisiana connection. That totally blew me away. I did not find her likable. I mean, I think she, you know, it's interesting that she went historically. She will always be remembered, but I thought she hurt a lot of people. She wasn't able to fix herself or know where to go to get help. And she left a trail of lies, of, I won't say adulterous behavior, though maybe she did. I think she did get married a few times. I can't remember exactly. I was skimming there. And she just was not likable, nor was her mother. I do wish they had had birth control back then, better birth control, and their family had not been so caught up in these really fundamentalist kinds of religions that are basically cruel. And, you know, I did find the doctor the abortionist doctor, interesting. He had started in that same sort of religion, that sort of narrow-minded kind of religion, and later became a Unitarian. I won't get into debating the politics of abortion here. I don't think that would be productive. I do wonder, though, how late can you go? Because they can now pretty much keep premature babies alive like at 21 or 22 weeks. So I'm wondering, what will the Supreme Court decide? I'll be very curious to see what the limits will be and how they will be, and if there's any way to encourage things like very cheap morning after pills, I don't know. This whole issue seems so complicated. One contact of mine, and then I'll stop, he said, it's deals with women. He thought maybe should women be the only people to decide it? But I don't know, because men are affected by it. Some men want the child and the woman says nope, and that's the end of that. So I'll go on and let someone else talk. Like I said, she just was not likable. I guess I shouldn't have expected her to be. The book wasn't about being liked. It was about a major issue of the day. And yes, it's very timely.
Well, this is Kathy Snyder. I'll go next. I thought this book was very well written, and it made all the difficult personalities, and the book's full of it. I mean, even the attorneys that argued Roe v. Wade, they had their own problems. Sarah Weddington is like a hero in Texas. And yet you find out she screwed over Linda Coffey, the attorney that was getting it started. And I mean, that's what I liked about the book, that the author was pretty honest, I thought, about exploring the entire thing. But here's the irony of reading this book. So Curtis Boyd has so we're in Dallas. So Curtis Boyd has his abortion clinic is not too far from us. And I've driven by it many times and seen the protesters and never, because that's what you see from the street, you know, as you're going down the street, because they have to stand back. Never, ever in my wildest dreams did I ever put two and two together that like, this is who this is. And I looked this dude up and I just was sort of appalled. He can't anymore because it's Texas, but in New Mexico, isn't it? He's still doing late term abortions. And I just was like, man, oh man, he sure switched from one thing to the other. And anyway, I just found that real fascinating.
Who was he again?
He's Dr. Boyd. What is his name?
Oh, that's Boyd. The one, Clive?
No, Curtis.
Curtis.
No, I'm looking at his picture. It's Curtis Boyd. And
he must be old.
He is.
He's dead.
No, I don't think he is yet. I looked this dude up. Okay, I have a personal reason for looking him up to see, because I think I actually met him a long time ago, 40 years ago. I think I had, anyway, he just, it's certain things in this book just jog my memory, but I can't really remember. And I just looked up, so I looked at this clinic and stuff. And then when I saw where it was, I'm oh my God, I've driven by there many times. Brad, it's at Forest and Greenville. No, it's at Greenville and Royal. And anyway, the whole thing was just really interesting. And all the people in it. And he just showed their true personalities, really, without sugarcoating any of them, which is what I thought was very interesting. And really, the whole issue of abortion is a tragedy, whether you're for it or against it. There's some aspect of tragedy and sorrow in it. And I thought that he acknowledged that. And not too many authors or politicians give both sides, or I wouldn't even say politicians, right. Promoters of whichever side, they never give both sides. But I thought he did a pretty good job, like, staying out of the weeds of being either too pro or too anti-choice. Right. Anyway, it was a long book, though. I got tired of it at the end. It was making my heart hurt.
Curtis Boyd's 81, according to my Echo. So.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I was going to say 79, but yeah, that's right. He's 81.
May I go next, please? It's Joni.
Yes.
Well, I started reading this book and I was absolutely fascinated by it. But then I had other books that I had to read for book clubs. And I set it aside. And I've been reading it off and on. I did not like Norma. She's a liar. I know that there are people that just don't want children. And yet she didn't, I mean, in those days, contraception was difficult, although the pill was just starting to come out. But she never did anything about contraception. And I read about 7 hours of the book, and I probably will go back to it. It is complicated keeping everybody straight, but I think that Joshua Prager is a really good writer and research.
Definitely.
Researcher. And so I admire when people do so much research and, I lived through this whole time. I would hear things about it, and I just felt terrible when the clinics were bombed and all this stuff. And it's a very hard issue to decide. I mean, in some ways you're pro-choice because how can a man decide what a woman should do with her body? And the unwanted children that are born and not adopted and not given care, my heart just aches for them. So I guess that's all I have to say. But, thank you for choosing this book. I was fascinated when I first started reading it, and I hope that I think I'll finish it.
Okay. This is Lynn. May I go next?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. Personally speaking, this was a beast of a book for me to listen to. And I'm almost gave up on it during the first part of the book, but I kind of soldiered on. I have to admire the author for his diligent research, and it just makes me think of, and I guess appreciate authors and historians, if I might use a biblical phrase, that can separate the wheat from the chaff or the chaff, and come to the conclusion that what's true is factual. This book's probably going to stay with me for a while. Like Alan had said first, kind of lived a life or brought up in a family with two parents and watching Leave It to Beaver. And I thought when I was a little kid that everybody was like me in our family. And, of course, they're not. Lots of things in this book shocked me. they were talking about the Southern Baptist Church, and I was somewhat aware that at one time the Southern Baptist Church was segregated until they finally saw the light. And now in this book, it seemed like they had a choice, freedom of choice kind of a thing for a while, where I let the woman choose before they switched back over. As for Norma herself, it made her lifestyle, well, not her lifestyle, excuse me, don't want to use that word, that phrase. It's that she, I was wondering who was playing who, where that was the pro-life Catholic group or the pro-choice people using her, or was she using them? And it just got to the point where who's going to give me the money so I can continue to live? It's just a beast of a book. The last thing I'll say, then I'll go on. I'll leave. In the book that we read about Northern Ireland and their problems or their troubles, I took away from that book, the idea that for me, that it's like extremes, and there's extremes on the right and extremes on the left. And in this book, it's the same thing. It's just too far one way or too far the other. Just extreme, extreme, extreme. Am I glad I read the book? I'm mixed emotions. I'll be quiet now.
I think the answer as to who was using who is both. Yeah, because no, I think a lot of it went around. Yeah, and Don, I think everybody's gone except for Jenny and you. So
that's right. If I can go next, I think then I can listen. Okay. I love this book. That's an odd thing to say. Let's say I found it very rewarding and very compelling. I found it difficult to read. I found it confusing, but. I think one of the things is, and I don't want to echo a lot of what other people said, but I think one of the things we have to remember is this is always, always, I think, going to be a very emotional issue, because while the most affected person is the woman whose options in life may be completely changed by carrying an unwanted pregnancy, but look at the other people involved. There's a potential grandparents, nieces, you know, aunts, fathers, grandfathers. All of these people have kind of an interest in this unborn child. And that's maybe why it's so emotional. And I lived through this period, but it was, it's like this is a, gives you the sweep of history 50 years later. I mean, I would read random newspaper articles. Keep in mind, there were books published. I'm so glad I didn't read them because apparently I Am Roe, which was written by Norma, was full of lies. And I am blown away by the author. Yes, 11 years, I can see that. The research, it reminds me for some reason of Truman Capote. There is meticulous, like, setting the scene and getting to the bottom of things. On the other hand, I don't think he claims in his book sometimes to qualify things. Like, he'll say, it seemed to be that, or something like that. But Norma is a very complicated person. And, you know, I really had so many different feelings about her. You know, I mean, she did so many detestable things. She deserted her devoted lover. She, you know, she was pretty honest and got her daughter's, placed in adoption, a good thing, too, you know. And she didn't want to be a mother, you know, yet. So this was a person that was set up for a lot of what professionals call pathology. I mean, you know, she was brought up conflicted by her church and then her desire to be gay and her desire to... So all of this stuff, I think at the end of it all, I have this admiration for her. Here she was, and she was had no education. She had, she still managed to have quite a life. She was right in the thick of things. And for a long time, I read scene after scene where she was donating her time to pro-life, talking to people, counseling people on both sides. She would work with telephones. And I think I just was struck, you know, I didn't read this carefully because it was a little unpleasant, but I think the people at the top, as all of you have very articulately put, could be a little callous. You know, the feminists didn't think that she, they were kind of like, oh, she's just, I had a feeling they felt she was kind of trashy. And then, yeah. They wouldn't have said that. Yeah. But here they are, supposed to be liberals and understanding and compassionate. And they really kind of made her feel awful about herself. That's why she was so ripe for the picking, I think, with the other side. And so I thought, okay, look at this woman. I mean, she, as the author said, she got in there with Gloria Steinem, all these powerful people, and kind of held her own in a way. And then I do think it's true that the Catholics, that one group, she had they had gotten billions of, contributions, but she didn't get very much at the end when she needed it. And, I think it is very timely. I when I was living through this, I didn't understand so much of it. And I really just really I'm so glad that we picked this book because it'll help me think through some of these issues. And I think at the end of the book, he was saying that abortions are on the decline. And no one really, there's nothing anybody, you know, yes, somebody said here it's very tragic and very sorrowful. No one is going to be happy about having to have an abortion. You know, so the natural tendency would be it does seem to be diminishing, and I'm really glad. And I guess that's all I have to say right now. I'm very glad we picked the book.
Well, thank you. Has everybody spoken?
Yes, except for you.
Except me. I did say, well, I've looked at when I was at a caseload. There were a few people like this, but fortunately, few. But that was always what the book kind of surprised me, though. I always thought that the hardest thing would be to get an abortion psychologically, as opposed to adopting your child out, which you weren't. But my family said, I understood that it was much more traumatic to give a child up in adoption than the abortion. So.
Well, Donald, it really depends on the woman and the situation, because a lot of women do find that abortions are very tragic, and the pro-life side will discuss that, and the pro-choice side will not discuss that. So it's really kind of an individual thing. And then we're not even, probably no research on what the fathers feel like, you know, if they even know about it or whatever. So that's it. I just want to throw that in there.
You know, San Diego was very conservative, but it had a very generous adoption center program. And they had built this very elaborate adoption center with two dual waiting rooms, one for the adoptees and those for the relinquishing. And then Ronald Reagan's abortion thing, and it pretty much put them out of business. They ended up putting the regular social workers there. Anyway, it did have an impact on adoptions. Anyway,
Jenny, I have one final thing to say. I think if I ever had a book written about me, I would want this author to do it, because was so tactful. He was so tactful. I mean, yes. Here you have somebody that they could have called so many names. They could have made fun of her. They could have called her hateful. They could have called her a million things. But here he is, and he did that with most of the characters. He was very tactful, he called her difficult. Okay, he didn't call her a monster. I mean, you know, and then most of the people in the book are not all good or all bad. And that's what I liked about the book. It seemed to be he must be a hell of a journalist. He had gone over the facts. He had thoughtfully thought about them, and he was so damn nice to Norma, really, when you think about it, you know, and I really admire that. And and not only to mention the fact that I don't think you can be quite this delicate and polite unless you have a command of the language, and he really is such a good writer, I think.
Yeah.
So
I can't even conceive how many people you have to talk to when you're trying to ferret out the truth, when you've got a cast of them like Norma that never tells the truth. I can't imagine how you dig out the actual facts, how many people you got to talk to try to confirm or reconfirm stuff. But she was something else. I can't even imagine, because she and the truth weren't very close friends, it didn't seem like. But
Well, and she obviously had a mental illness. I thought one of her daughters wrote about the daughter being diagnosed bipolar, but yet he never came out and said, well, she's mentally ill, or she's a narcissist, or she's toxic. I mean, I thought he was very tactful, and he described her behavior.
Right.
I think we all got a picture of somebody that we just probably wouldn't want to be friends with.
Yeah. Exactly.
Well, and now for the promo. Yeah, we're almost out of time, so we better squeeze in my little tiny promo.
Yeah, David, give us a very short promo.
It's short.
You ready? Here goes the promo.
You have started computer audio share. Voice over off.
The book discussion for Tuesday, April 5th, 2022, will be centered on the book The Engineer's Wife by Tracy Enerson Wood, DB101544. This book tells of how Emily Roebling, wife of Washington Roebling, has to step in to take over directing the workers who are building the Brooklyn Bridge because her husband has become ill due to Caisson's disease, which we know today as the Benz, a bridge that connects Manhattan with Brooklyn. Join me Tuesday, April 5th, for The Engineer's Wife by Tracy Enerson Wood, DB101544.
Can I say something? Roebling also designed a bridge between Cincinnati, Ohio, and Northern Kentucky.
They mention it. They do mention that.
The suspension bridge.
They certainly mentioned that. That was done before Brooklyn.
Yeah.
They certainly do mention that.
And he I'm a native Cincinnatian.
Oh, that's why.
All right.
This, go ahead.
So that's, you know, well, that's all I was going to say, but been over that bridge millions of times.
I haven't been over it, yeah.
Could you please repeat the number and the title?
The number was DB101544, and the title was The Engineer's Wife.
Thanks, Brad.
Pause recording.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you all for coming tonight before the presidential address.
Yes.
So I.
Great discussion. Great discussion. Yes. Yeah.
Really good. Yes.
Wonderful.
We'll talk to you guys next month.
Thank Brad.
I'm going to get on the TV.
Me too.
Okay. Bye, everybody.
Mike, brother.
Bye.
Yeah. Good night.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Good night. Good night, everybody. Stay safe.